Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. It's the first Thursday of the month, so as a new feature we've just incorporated into the show, music critic Joshua Cosman will be joining me later this hour to talk about the month ahead in classical music. He'll also be sharing his Grammy picks in the classical category, which includes music from 8th Blackbird and our own San Francisco Symphony. But please, no wagering. And the main focus of this week's show is two different operas for both of my guests, and interestingly, both operas set in Spain, one during the 15th century, Verdi's Il Trovatore, one of the 23rd most performed operas in the world. It's in a new production at Opera San Jose, which draws its inspiration from Game of Thrones. Assistant conductor Andrew Whitfield will be in studio to talk about that production shortly. And Opera Parallel here in San Francisco has a new opera, the first written by contemporary composer Osvaldo Golijov, which is set in 20th century Spain at the time of poet Federico Garcia Lorca and recalls his struggle against fascism in Spain. I recorded an interview with the conductor of the opera, Aina Damar, Nicole Paimon, last night, and I'll share that and some of the music from that opera as well. So stay with us. That's the familiar anvil chorus, which opens Act Two of Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore, now at Opera San Jose. That's not a recording of Opera San Jose, but a production from the 1961 New York Metropolitan Opera cast, which featured current Opera San Jose general director Irene Dallas among the company. Andrew Whitfield, who is currently assistant conductor of Opera San Jose and will in fact be conducting two of the performances, joins me now in studio. Andrew is a fairly recent transplant from New York, where he was music director for Amato Opera and conducted over 200 performances with that company, and returned to New York recently also to conduct for the Amore Opera Company. Andrew, welcome to KLW.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's first talk about the plot of Il Trovatore for those who might be unfamiliar with the story. It's got it all. Vengeance, war, jealousy, passion, of course.
Well, I mean, I can't hope to make sense out of it in sort of a contemporary structure, but it's basically it deals with raw emotions, and it deals with revenge, and it centers around this occurrence that happened 20 years prior to the opera, in which this gypsy woman, Azucena, on the way to watching her mother burn at the stake, so, I mean, happy stuff, decided...
It's a Walt Disney production.
Exactly, yeah. It decided, in a fit of vengeance, to take revenge by throwing the king's baby into the fire, except when she had done that, she realized she had thrown her own baby into the fire. So not only is her mother burning on the stake, her own child is burning in the stake. But she decides, out of pity, to take this other baby, the king's baby, and raise it as her own. So fast forward 20 years or so, and Azucena's son is now a grown man, and he is rivals with the son of the king, the duke, and rivals in war and also rivals in love. And they're chasing after the same woman, Leonora, and obviously Leonora is interested in the tenor, which is how generally opera works out. And towards the end, finally, the Duke gets a hold of Manrico and his mother, and he condemns him to death. And the final punchline of the opera is that Azucena reveals that was your brother. And he says,
dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. Don't you hate when that happens?
Well, operatic in every sense.
Exactly.
This production, it's a fairly traditional staging, I believe, but it's being billed as a massive production and is inspired by HBO's Game of Thrones. Now, how so? And for those unfamiliar with Game of Thrones, let's get a PG version of that show for people.
Well, it's funny. I've just recently become completely addicted to it, and I've been watching it ad nauseum these past week or so. It is interesting to watch that show and also be working on this opera. I mean, it's mostly the look and feel of the opera is very much akin to Game of Thrones. And it's also, I mean, this is not, they didn't spare any kind of details in really conveying the brutalness of this opera. And there's some, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but the director, Brad Dalton, really tried to highlight the brutality of this story and in a way that would look very similar to an episode of Game of Thrones without the special pyrotechnics of and wizardry of computer animation.
Okay, I was going to say, so Game of Thrones, give us what's going on in Game of Thrones, really, on the HBO series.
Well, I can only speak to, three episodes away from the second season.
Okay.
But it's about intrigue and about, you know, people who have a claim to the throne and people who don't agree with that. And just, I think, this constant turmoil that existed probably up until 100 years ago, in which, especially in Europe, you know, these little fiefdoms were at war with one another and, you know, had these ancient blood rivals with one another. So it speaks to that. And it'll resonate with the people who watch Game of Thrones.
Uh-huh. The opera by Verdi is going to be sung in Italian with English super titles, so people will really know what's going on.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit more about the production without giving away too much.
Well, it has a very kind of dark feel. The set is minimal but very effective. There's a staircase that takes on different forms and sort of conveys different settings and lighting. And it's just a really, I think, conveys the darkness of it and the dirtiness of the story. You know, this is not a polite opera.
Mm-hmm. Now, your role as assistant conductor, you'll actually be conducting two of the eight performances. Mm-hmm. The other one's being conducted by principal conductor David Rohrbaugh. Your role has been, I guess, for the uninitiated, to be sort of sous chef to the grand feast that is the grand opera, preparing the chorus and the orchestra. What exactly is your behind-the-scenes role in preparing this production?
Well, I think, there's obviously the nitty-gritty aspects of it, you know, making sure that the parts look good for the orchestra, making sure the cuts are all in place, taking care of a lot of the smaller details that the main conductor probably wouldn't want to focus on. That's more of the big picture, you know, role. And I think also just any assistant, probably in any capacity, serves as sort of the go-between and the liaison. So if the director has an issue and is not, you know, has an issue with the music, usually they'll come to me and I will try and then convey that. And so you are almost like Switzerland, trying to maintain everybody's you know, good feelings towards one another throughout the run.
Also preparing the chorus.
Well, that's a separate job. I wear two hats, and that's not usually the case, but I am the resident chorus master at Opera San Jose, and so I did prepare this chorus as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and it's one of our largest that we've ever had.
Also nice that you're going to be given the spotlight for a couple of the performances. That's a nice bonus.
Yes, I'm very grateful.
Your work back in New York was quite extensive with Amato Opera. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the productions you've done down there.
Oh, I mean, I don't know where to begin. It was there for 9 years. They did 72 performances a year, but it was, for those who don't know what the Amato Opera was, it was started in 1947 by Anthony Amato, and he had this vision of keeping it very small, and it became the only self-sufficient opera company in the world. And he bought a building in 1963 or so and converted it and created the smallest opera house in the world. It sat about 120. It had a stage the length of maybe 15 feet. But he put on these grand operas like Aida, La Forza del Destino, Cavpag, and that kind of thing. And you really got a chance to experience in a almost claustrophobic, but certainly very intimate setting.
I remember I'm a transplanted New Yorker myself, and that was quite a... I always heard about the Amato Opera productions and how amazingly he could pull those things off.
Yeah.
Let's back get back to Opera San Jose and the cast that's been assembled for this. Can it be difficult wrangling? I mean, opera singers are notoriously need to be pampered. Mm-hmm. They've got very fragile voices for the most part. Is it difficult wrangling these kinds of egos for an opera production?
Well, you become deft at learning how to do it, and certainly, you know, a lot of compliments will get you a long way with a singer who might not be on board with an idea or another. And so, yeah, you look and you try ultimately to appeal to the good of the show. And I think everyone's ego aside, most people are ultimately interested in the show coming off as well as possible. Mm-hmm. So we're very fortunate.
Talking with Andrew Whitfield, who is not only the chorus master, but assistant conductor of Opera San Jose's production of Il Trovatore, which runs through the 24th of February. Information at operasj.org. Principal conductor, Mr. Rohrbaugh, will be conducting the rest of the performances. David Rohrbaugh, sung in Italian with English super titles. It's at the California Theater on South First Street in downtown San Jose. The design is, again, based on Game of Thrones, so you're in for a grand experience going on here. Now, we do have a clip from one of the singers that is involved in the production. It's Nicole Berkland singing an aria, Strida della Vampa, her role as Azucena. Could you tell us a little bit about Nicole, if you could, and about this very famous aria?
Well, Nicole is incredibly talented mezzo-soprano, and she is truly the rarest of voice type in that she is a true dramatic voice. A dramatic meaning the orchestra basically doesn't stand a prayer against her instrument, and she can go up to a high C and down to a low A with just remarkable ease. Makes her extremely valuable because those kinds of voices are extremely rare.
The role, again, Azucena, mm-hmm. as the gypsy woman.
She's the gypsy mother, right.
And this Strida della Vampa, what is she singing about here?
She is recalling, it comes actually directly after the anvil chorus, which we just heard, and she sort of stops the show and because she's obsessed with this event that happened in her life, and she's basically recalling seeing her mother being taken and led to the stake and having her crying child with her, and just the horror of the whole event, which really puts a damper on the otherwise festive nature of the anvil chorus.
Well, with that happy introduction, Andrew, I will thank you for coming into Open Air today.
My pleasure.
And we'll hear Opera San Jose's Nicole Berkland singing that famous aria, Strida della Vampa, from the second act of Il Trovatore as Azucena, music of Giuseppe Verdi. Berkland singing Strida della Vampa in her role as Azucena in Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore. It's at Opera San Jose now through the 24th of February. My guest, Andrew Whitfield, will be conducting two of those performances on the 17th and 19th of February. David Rohrbaugh conducting the rest. It's a production that was designed by Stephen Kemp and is based on HBO's Game of Thrones, so you're in for quite a production if you make it out to Opera San Jose, down on South First Street in San Jose. Tickets available through the Opera San Jose box office website, www.operasj.org. More opera to come here on KLW and Open Air. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe. Music critic Joshua Cosman will also be on hand to talk about the month ahead in classical music. Contemporary opera next, and another work set in Spain, although this one by composer Osvaldo Golijov, inspired by the confrontation between poet Federico García Lorca and the fascist regime of Spain during the Spanish Civil War, with a libretto by American playwright, librettist, and screenwriter David Henry Hwang, perhaps best known for his play M. Butterfly. Earlier this week, I spoke with Nicole Paimon, who is conductor and music director of Opera Parallel, formerly known as Ensemble Parallel, a group that is to contemporary opera a very important entity. She's done works that have been extensively reviewed to great acclaim. We're so glad that she took some time to speak with us here at KLW. Our conversation started with her describing the significance of the title of the opera, Ein Adamar.
Actually, the title comes from a place, actually, that was outside of Granada, where in the early 5th centuries, people, the Moors, actually, would go there. It was actually a fountain for peace, so they would actually celebrate love and peace of different cultures coming there. And eventually, in the Franco regime, it went into a very different place where they started to execute people at that fountain. So all of a sudden, the purity of that fountain became, the idea of water became the idea of blood at that fountain. So we refer, Ein Adamar is translated as the fountain of tears because of that.
Is it the place also where Lorca was killed?
It is believed that this is where Lorca was executed, yes. I mean, you know, there are some specialists of Lorca that think that that's not exactly the truth, that he was there, but that he actually was executed a little further out. But he was definitely at that fountain along with some other people that were executed on that same day.
Was this project proposed to you? Is this something that you collaborated with to make happen? How did this come about?
Actually, what we try to do, I mean, we have kind of a few main goals with our organization. One of them is that we're trying to really broaden the audience base of who goes to opera. And that's one of the reasons why we actually like to perform at YBCA, because already that's a place where a different kind of performances are being held and where a clientele is quite different than perhaps the major opera house. And so we really are very careful when we are choosing repertoire to try to vary it enough so that we are pulling in a new kind of audience. And also because another thing is we are also sort of seeking to redefine what opera is in the 21st century, and we like to work in parallel, that's where our name comes from, with other organization and other artistic form. This opera felt like it was our next step because it has a lot of inspired music from southern Spain at the time, so a lot of Moorish, a lot of flamenco, gypsy sounds and that. So we could actually collaborate with the large artistic community of the flamenco artistic community in the area, not only dancers, but also players, musicians, and also the people that are interested in flamenco sounds and art would be coming to the opera house. So it just felt like this was the right choice. But we definitely decided ourselves, and we keep, I mean, I think that's probably something we do daily, is discuss. We have a very tight-knit artistic team, and we talk about works and when would that work fit well in our 5-year plan to develop basically a large clientele and to really open the door to opera in San Francisco.
Could you tell us a little bit about the music of Osvaldo Golijov and how he incorporates flamenco into the larger score of the opera?
Yes, it's actually, I mean, for those, I think probably many know Golijov because he's quite a prolific composer. And as we know, he was born in Argentina, but coming from a background of a Jewish family from Eastern Europe, he himself traveled through Africa and through many countries. And I think of him a little bit as a music polyglot, you know, of all these things, though he really combines them into his own personal voice. And in this piece, in trying to really paint the story of Federico Lorca, what he does is that he doesn't do a pastiche or sort of fake the castagnette of Carmen by Bizet or something like that, but he actually truly incorporates sounds of that culture. So basically in the orchestral pit, you will have guitars, which you normally do not have in opera. You have a whole, the percussion section will have your traditional classical percussion section, but will also be combined with the cajon and with the palmas. And so there'll be a combination of these sounds into the orchestral sound to really create a true organic flamenco sounding orchestra at times. What is interesting, however, is that depending, this story is based on flashbacks of the story of, basically we hear of the story of Lorca through the eyes of Margarita Xirgu, who was a very close friend of Federico Lorca, but was, and was an actress, who actually left Spain and had to leave Spain because of Franco and continued to promote Lorca's plays in Latin America. And so she, when the opera starts, we are at in 1960s, and she's actually going to go on stage to perform one of her of Lorca's play, which will actually be her last performance before she dies. And she starts to have flashback on her relationship to Lorca, and we experience the whole story through different flashbacks. And so in that way, the music will flash back. At times we'll be in Spain. At times we're going to be in Latin America. And at times we're going to be beyond that. We're going to be in the depth of their relationship and what it meant to fight for freedom. And at that point, you have a very international musical language that goes beyond the Spanish influence or the cute Latin American influence, but more the voice of Golijov himself.
Could you familiarize our listeners who may not be aware of Lorca's struggle against fascism, how this all comes into play?
Well, you know, he was a person, as we all know, a person that believed in had a very deep belief in speaking of freedom for people to have their own capacity to express what they needed, and he believed in the people. And what Federico Lorca did was actually he used words rather than guns to basically make a point about how he felt society should go, which was very different way than what Franco was believing the society should go. But there's actually a line in the opera that says that he, Federico, you have used, the fascist in the opera says, you know, you have used your words are more cruel than guns could be, or something like that. So basically, he used his art form to propagate what he believed in.
Talking with Nicole Paymal, who is conducting Aina Damar, a new opera by Osvaldo Golijov. It's at the Yerba Buena Center next Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. Next Sunday at 2 p.m. Now, Nicole, this production uses what's known in the operatic world as a pants role, mm-hmm. a woman playing a man's part, in this case Lisa Chavez, singing the role of Federico Garcia Lorca. Have you talked with composer Osvaldo Golijov about why that choice was made?
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, you know, there are, I think, quite a few reasons for that. I think he had in mind a particular singer that he felt would fit well that character. And my interpretation of it is actually that, because to be honest, at first we struggled and felt that perhaps we would try to use a countertenor to do the role. And we actually contacted the composer, and he felt that was a good idea. And he said, oh, it's sometimes even done with the baritone. But then I really started to study the score and to think about, and we as our creative team came together, we thought the idea of having Lisa Chavez in the Pant role gives a universality to Lorca and to the message that goes far beyond that character. And we liked that. And we thought, and, you know, some people will say, oh, well, you know, as we know, Federico Lorca was also an homosexual, which was one of the reasons some people believe he was also executed. And the fact that already he's, you know, he is a woman in the opera could have that connection. But I really don't think that is the case. I think it's mostly, for me, the depth of having this female voice sing in a very low range. However, the role of Lorca really gives this universality to his character. And I really like that a lot, actually. There is also another thing that happens is that in the middle of the opera, we get to the execution of the of Federico Lorca. And at that point, actually, it's extremely well written in that we actually, inside the operatic structure, you have a passion play. And you have these three movements, and they're right in the middle, and, you know, three movement, and you get to very Christian music. We leave the gypsy sounds, we leave all of that. We get this chanting, this almost Gregorian chant, and you have you have Federico Lorca coupled with two other men, with the teacher and a bullfighter. So it's like Christ with his two, how do you say in English, who were beside him at the...
Disciples.
Yeah, disciple. Okay. I didn't know the word in English, sorry. The two disciples that are there at his execution. And the fact that, and beside him, there is a character named Tripaldi, who actually was a guard, who actually historically was at Lorca's execution, offered him a cigarette before he actually was killed. So all of a sudden, in the middle of the opera, you have this passion play with more Christian music, and you have male voices, and it gives an impact that would never have happened if you had had Lorca as a male throughout. And the low range of the mezzo-soprano Lisa Chavez mixes with that you forget that she is a woman, and it really creates a male sound right there. So it's actually very powerful.
And a very spiritual element to the entire production.
Very spiritual, yes. Yeah, and the way that it stages actually so... empowering. It's very, very
I wanted to
powerful.
Ask you a little bit about the production team. Mm-hmm. It also includes stage direction by Brian Staubenfield, with scenic and lighting designer Matthew Antaki, and video artist Austin Forbord. Austin was a recent guest here on Open Air as a filmmaker of Stage Left, a story of theater in San Francisco. What's innovative about the visuals that we'll see for this production?
Well, we've had this same team for quite a while. We've worked very much together, and we actually sit and really have a lot of brainstorming and really try to think of how we want to put an opera to the stage. Again, thinking by incorporating various artistic fields, we're going to bring in more people to the audience, because they'll be interested in dance or in film or in other things. So it brings all these elements together. And it's also, I think, a way to have opera survive in the 21st century, to be honest, to have all these art form combined. So Brian Staubenfield is more than our stage director. He creates the concept of the production. And once he has that production, he is actually works very close with Austin. And together they think of how visually they're going to create, use technology basically to enhance the sets and costume, and that we have sets with Matthew or the costume. We have a wonderful costumer and a wonderful wig and makeup artist also that work with us. And basically with Austin, they really think about how they could enhance all of these sort of more traditional aspect of opera. In this one, it's very interesting, because we decided on on the concept of this quite a while ago, last February, actually. And then this summer, we went to, I think it was this summer, we went to see the exhibit of, I think it was Christian Dior at the De Young. And I don't know if you saw it, but they had these mannequins, and they had this projection on the mannequins that was, it's called mapping. And basically, you could see the mannequin came alive and spoke. Well, we had decided last February that we were going to have the statue of Mariana Pineda. Basically, if I go back for a second, the first play that Lorca had success with was the play Mariana Pineda. And this play was based on a heroine from the 19th century who also fought for freedom of speech in Spain. And when Lorca was a small boy, he could see from his window, from his home, the statue of Mariana Pineda. So he wrote this play, and then Margarita Xirgu, friend of Lorca, played the role of Mariana Pineda through her life. So in this play, we have Margarita Xirgu, we have this, we speak about Mariana Pineda, this heroine from the, and we have Lorca. These three people are all heroic people. They all fought for something that they believed in truly. Margarita Xirgu being the words of Lorca, and Lorca sort of being influenced by Mariana Pineda and being believing of freedom of speech. So what we did was what we actually created in, we casted a statue of Mariana Pineda, but in the body of the person who is singing the role of Margarita Xirgu. So when you're on stage, you see the statue, this that's all been casted, and it looks like our singer, the Catalan actress, but it's actually also representing, blending basically those two characters. But at times we are going to even map on it the face of Lorca speaking so that all these three characters become one.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And so that's one. So we're going to do mapping. That's one of the thing. And we're also going to do a lot of other visual. That play, Mariana Pineda, was actually very successful because the sets were designed by Dan at the time.
Oh my gosh.
And we actually have reproduced some of those Dali in, they will spring out in the video and they will burst, they will pop up on stage, reminding us of the images of Dali.
Well, that's fantastic how, you know, your own influences outside of the world of opera come and influence this new work. It's a really encouraging production that's being brought to life at the Yerba Buena Center. Nicole, thanks so much. The Nicole Paimon and on Opera Parallel present Ina Damar. It's music of Osvaldo Goliev with a libretto by David Henry Huang. It's inspired by the confrontation between poet Federico Garcia Lorca and the fascist regime during the Spanish Civil War. It includes La Tania and her flamenco dancers, as well as an outstanding vocal cast. It's at the Yerba Buena Center for the Performing Arts next Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock, Sunday at 2 o'clock. Tickets at ybca.org. Nicole, thank you for coming in. I'm wondering if you do us the pleasure of introducing the music that we'll be finishing with here.
Yes, what we will be hearing is the penultimate movement of the opera. And at that point, we are in the third act. They call them images in the, Goliev calls them images, but they are acts. And basically, at that point, they are saying, doy mi sangre, give me blood. And they are basically leaving this earth. It comes into a very spiritual moment where the three lead singers sing together. Basically, I think what I would refer to as a prayer for the hope of humanity.
Music of Osvaldo Goliev, conducted by Nicole Paimon. Nicole, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
excerpt from Al-Nadamar. It's music composed by Osvaldo Goliev with a libretto by David Henry Huang. We heard an excerpt performed by Opera Parallèle, Nicole Paimon conducting. Opera Parallèle being devoted to multidisciplinary projects and chamber opera resident ensemble at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Nicole has led the ensemble in acclaimed and innovative productions of works like The Great Gatsby, Virgil Thompson's Four Saints in Three Acts, and Alban Berg's Wozzeck, among other projects. This opera is being presented next Friday and Saturday at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and next Sunday at 2 p.m. Information at ybca.org. David LaTulipe, now joined by music critic Joshua Cosman here in the KLW studio, someone no doubt familiar with the work of Opera Parallèle.
Very much so. I was just thinking about all those productions that you mentioned, and I think I've seen and covered them all. Going back even further to their first production, which was to revive Lou Harrison's great, weird opera, Young Caesar, about Julius Caesar's homoerotic youth, which was a problem piece that had been, that had lain sort of undiscovered for a long time, and they got it back on stage.
Soon to be a Walt Disney picture.
Absolutely. Family values all over the place.
Hey, before we move on to some things that are coming up in February, I should mention that this opera, Al-Nadamar, get it out of my tongue here, does have a free open rehearsal this Friday at the Canbar Center at 44 Page Street. It's from 6:30 to 8, 44 Page at the Canbar Center, a free prelude, open rehearsal of this opera, which will be performed next week, Al-Nadamar of Osvaldo Goliev and Opera Parallèle. Joshua, that's one thing that's coming up that I'm sure you're looking forward to in the month of February. What else are your picks for us to keep on our cultural calendar?
Well, there's a lot of things coming up this month that are looking good, but I want to start with something that's happening right now, not literally as we speak, but almost, which is this week's program by the San Francisco Symphony with guest conductor Charles Dutoit, which I heard last night in Davies Hall, and it's really a knockout. There's two more performances left on Saturday and Sunday afternoon, and this is the first two great and strange and wonderful works of French choral music, the Stabat Mater of Francis Poulenc, which is being done for the first time, and then the Berlioz Te Deum, which is a piece that the symphony has done only once before in 1973, and it is Berlioz at his biggest and weirdest and most unpredictably great. It's got massive choral writing and a big organ that thunders through the hall. It was originally conceived to be a kind of spatial blowout with the organ at one end of the hall and these massive choruses of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of singers at the other. That doesn't happen in Davies. Everybody's kind of on the stage together, but it's still a wild and unpredictable ride, and Dutoit is just a master of this kind of stuff.
And the orchestra seems to love him.
Yeah.
They really do. I mean, they respond to him tremendously in giving him ovations after his work. I'm looking forward to the performance as well on Saturday, mm-hmm. So it should be really something. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention also on the symphonic front coming up tonight, the Berkeley Symphony has its performance under director Joanna Carneiro. On the performance with guest soloist Lynn Harrell as cellist performing Witold Lutoslawski's Cello Concerto, Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, Opus 45, and another world premiere commission, continuing their mission, as she likes to call it, by Andrea Pinto Correa, called Alfama, about a neighborhood in her native Lisbon, Portugal. So that's tonight at Zellerbach Hall, which will be broadcasting on the 19th and 20th of May. So catch it tonight or wait for the broadcast.
Are you hosting those broadcasts?
I will be, yes.
Great. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. That's in fact, I'm going to head over there very soon.
Oh, great. Good.
So I will be there. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's coming up this month is the 10th season of a really good local organization called Chamber Music San Francisco. This is sort of a one-man operation, more or less. I'm a guy named Daniel Levenstein, who's been around on the scene for a good long while. I don't want to discount anybody else he's got working with him. I don't know that he doesn't. But he sort of started it, and it seemed like a very risky undertaking to add a new chamber program in the Bay Area where we already have such a wealth of chamber music, but he's made it work. This is now his 10th season, and he's starting this Sunday with the violinist Sarah Chang, and the season runs through the end of May, always with concerts in San Francisco, in Walnut Creek, in Palo Alto, and he's always got a terrific lineup, some really A-list headliners like pianist Richard Good, the Tokyo String Quartet, and one that I'm particularly looking forward to, which is not until March, which is the Polish pianist whose name I'm going to try and pronounce, Rafał Blekasz.
Blekasz,
you think? Yeah, my Polish is rusty. But he's coming there. And then also some local folks, pianist Garrick Olson, and in past seasons he's had a regular sort of chamber series of local musicians. So that's coming up the 10th season very soon.
And information about those concerts at chambermusicsf.org.
Yes, exactly so.
A singer that you've been interested in sharing some information about, Susanna Phillips. Can we talk about her?
Sure. Susanna Phillips is a young soprano out of Alabama who I've been really looking forward to hearing live for a long time. She's coming to Berkeley at the end of the month, and I'll just back up and tell you that it was about 10 or 12 years ago, maybe a little more, I got a call from some folks at Lucasfilms in Marin, and they were putting together a series of educational documentaries for a series called the Young Indie Documentaries. This was connected in some way that I don't understand with the whole Young Indiana Jones franchise. They were putting together a whole series of maybe dozens, maybe more, I don't know, little half-hour documentaries for use in schools and so forth on you know, every topic under this, any topic that you might find in a kid's encyclopedia. And they were doing a couple on opera, and would I come over and be a talking head? So I said, sure. And I went over there, and I got interviewed. We talked about Puccini. We talked about opera as a genre. We talked about Marriage of Figaro. And I went home, and I didn't think anything about it. And I never heard anything more. And about 3 years later, literally, you know, after all the post-productions, there was this preview disc lands in my mailbox. It was a DVD of the thing, and you know, and the first thing I thought was, "Geez, I look fat. I didn't look at the camera. You know, all the kind of vanity stuff that was that comes first." But the next thing I noticed was they had the hour on opera and on Marriage of Figaro. They had intercut with a lot of performance footage from the Music Academy of the West, which is this training program that Marilyn Horn started and runs in Santa Barbara. Young singers get a lot of training. And they were, you know, these kids, students, doing these scenes from Marriage of Figaro. And one of them was a soprano who was singing The Countess. And I kind of went, wow, this gal is really something. And I sort of took out my notepad and I said, Susanna Phillips, I've got to remember this one. I don't know that stuff has ever been broadcast, or if it has, it was in a schoolroom somewhere. But I remember the name, and lo and behold, you know, sort of about a year later, I'm reading cast lists from Santa Fe Opera and from the Chicago Lyric and from the Metropolitan, and suddenly she's got a big career. I thought, yes, I was right. I knew it right from the beginning. And so far, she has not sung here, so that's why I'm very excited to hear. She's got a wonderful CD that she released a year ago on Bridge, with music by Messiaen and Debussy. And we can hear a little this Debussy. This is the first of the Ariette Oubliette called C'est l'Extase. It's coincidentally the piece that Renee Fleming just sang last month with the San Francisco Symphony.
Susanna Phillips. Thank you. music of Claude Debussy, C'est l'extase. The singer was Susanna Phillips. That's from a Bridge CD called Paysage. Susanna, a pick of Joshua Cosman, someone to watch and who has made quite a name for herself already, will be performing on the 24th of February at Hertz Hall as part of Cal Performances. Go to calperformances.org. Yes, a beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really. And a wonderful, some wonderful choices of repertoire, too. She's not singing Debussy on this month, but she is singing some Messiaen and Berg and Chausson and some other repertoire as well. She's really kind of seems to be interested in exploring some of the byways of the song literature, which I always like in a singer.
I was prompted by a rather interesting article in the Chronicle about Grammy nominations and Grammy winners that should not have been. Uh-huh. There weren't, I think it was like the 12 worst Grammy moments, so it was kind of a disparaging article about who really should have won. But of course, none of these people mentioned anything in the classical recordings, and I'd like us to spend a little bit of time, given that it's Grammy weekend coming up on Sunday, to the oft-neglected but well-represented in the classical world, especially from MTT and the San Francisco Symphony, Grammy winner multiple times. Let's talk a little bit about the classical recordings that are going to be as a part of the Grammy nominations.
Okay, sure. I mean, as you say, let's acknowledge right off the bat that you know, the classical recordings is not what the Grammys, you know, are about. We're the you know, the technical achievements awards. Right. So, you know, at the Oscars, they put them in a separate tent and they do it on a separate day. It's the same kind of thing. But those of us who care about this do, you know, do like to know.
And it certainly helps sell records, that's for sure.
I think it does. Yeah. It certainly doesn't hurt if you can say Grammy nominated or Grammy winning. Mm-hmm. That's a badge of something or other. There's a couple of nominations that are sort of local this time around. One, as you say, is the San Francisco Symphony with Michael Tilson Thomas. They've got a disc of two pieces by John Adams, the Harmonie Lyrae, which is his great orchestral masterpiece from 1985, and Short Ride in a Fast Machine, which is the sort of a little curtain raiser that is on the disc with it.
And that's once again on their own label, which is a new trend in some
exactly
of the major
so. In fact,
orchestras.
A lot of the nominations, if you look down the list, there's very few of them anymore that are on the labels that we used to recognize from our childhood as being the major labels. There's only sort of, I don't want to say minor labels, but there's, you know, it's all niche stuff now, which is kind of nice. I mean, it makes for a much livelier and more diverse sort of ecosphere, I think, in the long run.
Mm-hmm. One of the nominees is Eighth Blackbird in one of the categories. I'm wondering if we have some music that you wanted to share of Eighth Blackbird.
Yeah, Eighth Blackbird is this is a disc on the Chicago label called Sedil, which started out doing mostly piano music and now is sort of branched out into a lot of very interesting repertoire that they record. And this is a just a fantastic recording, which is up for not one but two nominations, one for a small ensemble performance and one for classical composition for one of the pieces that's on it, a piece written by the composer Stephen Hartke called Meanwhile, which is incidental music to imaginary puppet plays. One of the things that I think is really striking about Stephen Hartke is that he's one of the few composers who really includes a sense of humor in his work. A lot of his music is witty and imaginative and funny in a way that if you think back on, you know, the past 400 years of classical music history, the composers that were funny are few and far between. You know, you got Haydn and you've got Mahler and you've got John Adams and there's not that many others. And Hartke is one of them, and that's one of the things that I really value about his music. It's also very imaginative and sort of spiky and delightful. And this is music that, as the title says, incidental music to imaginary puppet plays. This is music inspired by ideas about Asian puppet theater from Bali and Japan and so forth. And it's the music that would occur during the puppet play, which doesn't exist.
Music of Stephen Hartke, Grammy-nominated composer, performed by Eighth Blackbird.
Music from Stephen Hartke from his Grammy-nominated... He's nominated for a contemporary classical composition on a Grammy-nominated album by 8th Blackbird. A pick of my guest Joshua Cosman sharing his Grammy picks for 2013. Joshua, you wanted to mention another local person that's on the radar.
That CD is in competition for the small ensemble performance with a disc, debut disc by a local group called the Zofo Duet. That's a piano duo consisting of Eva Maria Zimmerman and Keizuki Nakagoshi. Zofo Duet, Z-O-F-O. Watch me now. Z-O is 20. F-O stands for Finger Orchestra. It's the 20-finger orchestra.
That's where they get their name. That's great.
So this is their first CD. I think it's on the Sonos label, and it's got music by Bernstein and Debussy and a piano forehand arrangement of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Mm. I have not heard the disc, but I've heard them live in performance, and they're absolutely first rate. So I'm wishing good things for them as well. Other good CDs to look out for. There's a couple of terrific CDs in the that are up for classical instrumental solo on both on the ECM label. One is pianist Andras Schiff playing Bach, and the other is the violist Kim Kashkashian, who has a disc of Kurtag and Ligeti.
Well, again, no wagering, please, but place your bets on the Grammys this year by watching this Sunday evening on CBS, or better yet, listen to this Open Air, Then and Now with Sarah Cahill from on KALW. We're going to close with a local favorite, my pick for a Grammy win, and probably yours as well, Joshua. Yes. Here is John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra in this Grammy-nominated recording. Josh, thanks for taking some time today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, David.
See you at the beginning of next month.
You bet.
San Francisco Symphony, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. On the San Francisco Symphony label, it's a Grammy nominee for Best Orchestral Performance. Also in that category, Mahler's First Symphony with the Budapest Festival Orchestra, Music for a Time of War with the Oregon Symphony, music of Carlos Kalmar conducting, Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances with Valery Gergiev and the London Symphony. But, you know, local boy makes good. I think it's going to be MTT and the San Francisco Symphony with their winning a Grammy this year. I'm David Latulipe. Thanks for listening to Open Air this week. Coming up next, an hour of news from the BBC. It's 2 o'clock.